Hey, y'all. How's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here on the Liberty Radio Network. It's kind of my thing. I wake up in the morning, read some stuff, do the show on the Liberty Radio Network. Appreciate you guys joining me. Hey, join up the chat room. Hang out in there. We got a good little list of people going on already. Hey, guys. How's things? Just go to scotthorton.org/chat. Fake name and a caption, you're in. Plain old browser window, don't need any external chat applications. But if you like those things, then just look for the IRC Freenode chat room, hashtag Scott Horton Show. And also, that's how you can tweet me. I'm at Scott Horton Show on Twitter. Hey, dude, how's it going? I see you in there. So send me tweets or retweet my tweets or condemn my tweets. Whatever you want to do. Twitter.com/Scott Horton Show. Okay, and yeah, hey, good news, man. Check it out. So, as you know, I did the audiobook for Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, and it's now gone from 3,000 something to number 64 on the list of audiobooks, political audiobooks, beating out Bill O'Reilly's new one. Did you know Bill O'Reilly was literate? Apparently he wrote a book. I guess maybe he had it ghostwritten and put his name on it. That's cool, though. Fascism versus Capitalism is beating it. So that's good. Go check that out. Just go to scotthorton.org. At the bottom of the right side of the page there, you'll see the big logo, Fascism versus Capitalism, and you can get, I guess that links to the Audible page, but it's also on Amazon.com. If you just look up Fascism versus Capitalism, it'll come right up there. And also, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get it for free. So how do you like that? Fascism versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell, narrated by me. I got a ton of news and I got a couple of interviews. I was kind of hoping for a third interview, but I guess it's not looking like I'm going to get that third interview. It kind of bums me out because there were some other interviews that I was considering trying to get. That's all right. Here, man, listen to this for a second. Okay, guys, it's summer fun drive time at the Scott Horton Show. Bills are piling up and equipment is wearing out. So here's the deal. Anyone who donates $50 or more gets a chance to win a week's vacation for two to Costa Rica. Drawing is July 15th. Winner, go whenever you want. See more details at scotthorton.org/raffle. Anyone who donates $100 or more gets entered into the raffle, plus a 1-ounce silver QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. And the first 25 people to donate $100 or more will also get a copy of Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax by Sheldon Richman, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me for free. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/raffle for details. You can also sign up for monthly donations by way of PayPal, per interview at Patreon, support with Bitcoin, and shop through scotthorton.org/Amazon. And thanks. Oh yeah, I forgot that part. You can get Fascism for Capitalism free as along with a raffle ticket if you donate $100 or more at scotthorton.org. This is some fun drive kind of thing going on right here. You know, it's a free market thing, but it's not really a price structure. It's kind of funny. I give the show away, and then I ask you to pay at the door what you want, like a museum donation. Or better, advertise your business on my show, if you want to do that. But anyway, assuming you like the show, and you would prefer to continue to be able to hear the show in the future, then yeah. Help support scotthorton.org/donate, scotthorton.org/raffle to learn all about that trip to Costa Rica that you can win and take whoever you want with you to. Well, I mean one other person. All right, cool. So lots of news. Gaza flotilla in international waters. There's four boats. I don't know all the details. There's four boats. One of them was boarded by the Israelis and then turned back, turned away. And I guess they went ahead and turned away. They were not all you know, assaulted and beaten and thrown in jail without communication for a few days or whatever, like back in 2010. There have been a couple of different attempts since then, I guess, too. But anyway, they do this to draw attention to the cause of the prisoners of the Gaza Strip concentration camp. And it's good that they do. And you know what? I'm so tired of Zionist trolls. Here's how you deal with a Zionist troll. Just tell them, I guess you think that the situation would be perfectly fine if the roles were reversed. And all the Palestinian Christians and Muslims had all the Israeli Jews penned up in the Gaza Strip and under military occupation in the West Bank. Is that how you think? That'd be perfectly cool, huh? You wouldn't mind at all. Because otherwise, what the Israelis are doing is wrong. Period. Yeah, so, obviously, give me a break. But a lot of people, they just don't understand it. You know, they hear about Israel, they don't know anything about it, except it's a shape on a map, and they've heard the myth that poor little Israel needs our help, because they're like our Fort Apache out there, taking on, terrible Muslim extremists out there. They're leading the front in the war. Of course, they're the cause of our war over there. It's a huge part of why the September 11th hijackers even attacked us in the first place, was to avenge the Israelis and to provoke a war with the Americans over American support for the Israeli occupation. But anyway, we're supposed to think of Israel over there as this, you know, isolated underdog surrounded by hostile powers and all this. But of course they're not, right? Hezbollah's just a militia. They're no offensive threat. Syria's being torn apart right now in part by, with Israeli help. And Assad was basically their little pet poodle anyway. He was never going to do nothing to them. Never made a peep about the Golan Heights or a damn thing. They said, get the troops out of Lebanon in 05. He pulled them out. Simple as that. The King of Jordan is just an American, British, Israeli sock puppet. Same thing for Sisi, the dictator of Egypt. So Israel's not surrounded by hostile powers. Israel is the dominant power in the Middle East. Israel has one of the most advanced armies in the world, thanks to your dime, all that money that came right out of your paycheck. And they use it not to defend themselves from the neighbors that besiege them, like in the mythology. They use it to besiege the people of the Gaza Strip, who are actually living out in real life that myth about Israel being surrounded by hostile powers, besieged and threatened with being pushed into the sea at any moment and all that kind of crap. It's the truth about the people of Gaza, and it's the Israelis that are doing it to them. They are Goliath, as Max Blumenthal put it in his book. And the people of Gaza, if the American people had any idea the truth of what's going on over there, they would be on the side of, hey, the underdog, the conquered. Maybe. I would like to think so. Anyway. So some heroes got on a boat, tried to bring some humanitarian supplies to the population of the Gaza Strip, turned away by the IDF, or whatever their navy, Coast Guard, whatever it's called. But just to get you to pay attention for a minute. So worked on me, let's pay attention for a minute. You know, more than half the population of the Gaza Strip are under 18. It's a majority minor population. How do you like that? More than 80% of them are refugees, and the children and grandchildren are refugees. They have official refugee status under international law. They were ethnically cleansed from what we now call Israel. And they're under total blockade, total siege. They can't cross into Israel. They'd be shot if they come anywhere near it or, you know, try to farm the land that's being steadily encroached by the Israelis on the border with Israel. And they only really pulled their troops out in 2000, or the settlers out in 2005, because they were serving as kind of shields and protectors, ironically, for the rest of the Gazans. But when they supposedly ended the occupation, all they really did was turn the place into a massive prison for the last decade. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, yeah, I'm going to have Patrick Coburn on soon to give us a year rundown thing. Prothero wrote a great thing. I never could get a hold of him, though. But, yeah. It's a year since ISIS, and there's a ton to talk about. And both of them, well, especially Patrick, is now writing a multiple-part series on the Islamic State, so... much to cover there. But I guess, you know, the big news is, as I guess you're aware, major strikes on three continents. That's the headline at antiwar.com. You now have people claiming the ISIS franchise, much more successful than Al-Qaeda ever was. Don't you hate that free market competition among terrorist groups, you know? So you got guys, claiming ISIS, whether they have any real direct link or not, spreading all over the world. In Nigeria, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt, in Saudi, Kuwait now, obviously Iraq and Syria, and even in Afghanistan, you have people claiming that they're with the Islamic State now. Screw the Taliban, we like these other guys better. That's mostly a fight over rich Gulf money, right? Donor money. As far as that goes, with the claiming of the different franchises and picking a winner, you know, the Al-Qaeda strategy was always we have to break the American empire and only then can we create an Islamo-fascist caliphate. And the Islamo-fascist caliphate decided they were tired of waiting. They were going to go ahead and create an Islamo-fascist caliphate, which is so funny to me because, of course, this is always the thinnest excuse of George Bush. You know, he actually one time even said to Katie Couric, "You know, the hardest part of my job is connecting Iraq to the war on terrorism." Oh, yeah, you think, huh? Because you have to lie, and it just doesn't make any sense. Except then he made it true, of course. He turned the whole place into a giant lawless jihadistan. Andrew Sullivan said, "Yeah, great idea. It's the flypaper thesis." Yeah, we'll just, We'll attract all the crazies from all around to Iraq that had nothing to do with the attack, nor did any of its population. And we'll just have them suffer as we attract all the crazies from all around the world there to fight. And then we'll kill them, and then they'll be dead, and then we'll have won. Uh-huh. Because that's how that works. Right? Just like flypaper has eliminated flies from the world. It's a great analogy. Anyway. They're now spreading all over the damn place. And it's a great argument for America stopping intervening right this minute since you didn't back when you should have before. There's nothing that America can do here that can make things better. If you side with any of the Islamic State's enemies, you only, in effect, make them more powerful by making them right about what you're doing. You try to train up the Iraqi army, that's already a proven failure. You send in the Iranians, you turn every Sunni in the region into a jihadist to go back to trying to contain the Iranian revolution. Same thing if you back Assad. And I'm not accusing the Americans of backing Assad. Of course, they've been backing the Al-Qaeda guys against him all this time. In effect, ISIS too. They've been supporting, as Hillary Clinton says in that clip I always play at the top of every show, you know, in that bumper there. She says, well, she's making the excuse for why she hadn't done more against Assad back in 2012 when she was Secretary of State still. And she says, well, Zawahiri has endorsed the rebellion against Assad. So do we want to help his guys by backing the rebellion against Assad? I mean, she wasn't saying, are we directly backing him? But she was saying, are we in effect backing him? And of course, she went on to directly back his guys. And especially indirectly, but still. Hey, FSA guys, here's a bunch of TOW missiles. Don't sell them to the guys who will actually take them to battle and use them now. Said the CIA. And anyway. Man, it's only getting worse. And it's funny, you think back, I never really took this serious enough to even comment on it really back, that much. Anyway, the political kind of, you know, I don't know, spin of 2011, 12, 13 that, yeah, Obama, he won the war on terrorism. He killed Osama bin Laden and he killed all the terrorists. He got us out of Iraq. It's all over now. And meanwhile, he's supporting the Mujahideen the whole time. And they're just growing and growing and growing, but they're sticking with the theme that, yeah, not like it's any big deal. Oh yeah, we overthrew the last secular commie bulwark against, Islamism in the center of North Africa there by knocking off Gaddafi, but, and spreading jihad down to Mali and making Boko Haram worse, which they already were down in Nigeria. They were already pretty bad, I mean to say. Bombing and destroying Somalia, doubling down on George Bush's bad bet in Somalia, where terrorists are thriving to this day. There's hardly any headlines. I see them on Twitter occasionally. I follow a couple of Somalia news organizations on Twitter, and man, massive bombings, people killed all the time. Whether they're claiming the Islamic State or not, it's the same difference. Al-Shabaab is, yeah, they're wannabe Islamic State, wannabe Al-Qaeda, whichever faction. And man, so look at this. This really proves my point. Turkey plans to invade Syria, but to stop the Kurds, not ISIS. The Kurds that have been fighting the Islamic State, our NATO ally Turkey, they're freaked out that the Kurds have carved out a semi-autonomous commie state, not like, I guess the Turks care how commie they are, but anyway, they've carved out a little semi-autonomous commie state and in northern Syria and on the Turkish border and, you know, separate from the jurisdiction of the Islamic State or Assad. And so apparently, and you know, this is in the context, they plan to do it. It's not the Turks have not rolled troops across the border, but still, the story shows you where their policy is. And, you know, I don't know, man. I need to get somebody on who can, you know, really state a detailed case for, you know, just what discrepancy, if any, there really is between American policy and Turkish and Saudi policy. Because, you know, on one hand, you have people like Mitchell Prothero who goes, oh, come on, America doesn't control what these countries do. And I'm going, come on, man, yeah, huh? But then on the other hand, you have people go, ah, hey, anything that Saudi or Turkey or even Israel does, it's all America's in on every bit of it. And it's their 100% well thought out and deliberated policy that this is exactly what they want to do, is back the Al-Qaeda and Islamic State guys, even to this degree where they're ruling in a real state that they've had for a year. As Coburn says, they rule more people than most member states of the UN right now and have. And I'm just not so sure where to... the truth is somewhere in the middle, I guess. Somewhere probably toward the more conspiratorial end, honestly. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, you own a business? maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton and Show. Here from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network every weekday. Our first guest up on the show today is Murtaza Hussein, and he is co-author with Razan Galanian, of this great article at The Intercept, Christie's Conspiracy, the Real Story Behind the Fort Dix Five Terror Plot. And, of course, Christie is a reference to the current governor of New Jersey, who's fixing to announce that he's running for president. He already is, really, running for president. And it turns out this case, he kind of rode on the back of it in order to get into the governor's office in the first place, it sounds like. I guess we don't know what would have been otherwise, but certainly made his bones on it. So that's very interesting. We all knew from the very beginning that the Fort Dix pizza plot was a giant hoax. Once you say informant, then we all know it was a giant sting operation. And the same thing that the FBI has done scores of times, as covered especially by Trevor Aronson, formerly of Mother Jones and now also at The Intercept in his book, The Terror Factory. But this is the best deep dive into the Fort Dix pizza plot that I've ever heard of. Very happy to see what you've done here. And I guess, first of all, I'll welcome you to the show and then ask you to please pronounce your co-author's name correctly for us. Sorry about that.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. And the co-author is Razan Azalain.
All right, great. Now, I guess I was kind of surprised to find out about this when it not only was this an entrapment job, but that actually it was only a half-successful entrapment job at best when it comes to the actual entrapping, and yet the people that the government failed to entrap, they were all sentenced to, was it life in prison anyway?
Yeah, life in prison. So, essentially, there were five guys who they were seeking to entrap. One guy, they basically got 22-year-old Mohammed Schnur. He went along with the informant, who was about, 36, 37, quite a bit older than him. There was another guy, Sardar Tatar, who was actually trying, he called the police and told him that I think this guy, the informant, who he didn't know was an informant, was a terrorist. He tried reporting him to the police a number of times, tried recording him. But somehow he also ended up getting entrapped because he gave him a map that he'd asked for, and he didn't get life, he got 30 years. And then the guys we focus on in the story, the Duca brothers, they didn't know about any plot or any map or anything at all. They didn't know about it, but due to their relation to Mohammed Schnur, he was a brother-in-law of one of these guys, and they ended up being charged with the crime anyways. And at trial, the prosecution and even the judge conceded, well, there's not any evidence these guys actually knew about the plot per se. There's no direct evidence, the words they used. But under conspiracy law in the United States, you don't have to prove that direct evidence. All you have to do is prove that they seem to have potentially known about it, although there was no evidence that they did.
Hmm. All right. Now, so rewind a second to the guy who you say that when the FBI sent the informant to entrap him, the first thing he did was call the cops and say, hey, some guy's trying to get me to do a terrorist attack. And then what happened after that? Nothing?
Well, he had been trying to talk to this guy, saying, we should do something, blah, 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 blah. And this guy, essentially, he called the police. He was a police officer who knew him. He used to come into 7-Eleven every morning to have coffee. He told him, look, I'm a terrorist. And I've been recording him on my cell phone, some of the things he's been saying. And this guy, Sardar, actually wanted to be a police officer himself. He'd actually asked that police officer several times if he can go along on ride-alongs with him and so forth. And the police officer said, well, I'll put you in touch with someone from the FBI. And then three weeks passed, and no one from the FBI contacted him. And finally, when someone did, they came by and they told him not to worry about it. And he tried showing them the recordings and said, well, I don't know what this is, and just forget about it. And then the same FBI agent was the guy who ended up coming to arrest him a few months later when this plot was uncovered, quote-unquote. And what's even more egregious is that the prosecution at trial said that these guys had gone on a trip to the Poconos to train, and they go on an annual Poconos vacation. This is how they first aroused the suspicion. And Sardar actually invited the police officer along on one of these trips, and he declined to go because he said, look, I think I want you to check out this guy. And so, you know, he tried everything he could to actually report the informant to the police.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, and now, I'm sorry I should have had a better structure to my questions here. Let's go back to that, the trip to the Poconos, because that's where the FBI first got interested in these guys, right?
Yeah, exactly. So these guys had gone to the Poconos mountains for a vacation in December of 2006, and they went there and they made a home video of themselves, like climbing trees and like riding horses and skiing, and they went to a shooting range as well. And so then they went to drop off this video to the shooting range and everything else to Circuit City because they thought it was just an annual vacation video, which they always take. And the Circuit City saw these like Muslim guys, at the shooting range and doing this other stuff, skiing and so forth. And he got alarmed and he called the police. And then the police initiated this investigation, which took about almost 2 years. Try to infiltrate them with informants and so forth, and then it resulted in these arrests. But it all was triggered by this dropping off of the home video at Circuit City.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of things there is, you know, you can figure that they thought, well, geez, you know, maybe the police ought to check this out, but it probably never occurred to the people who called 911, you know, the rat at Circuit City, probably never occurred to them that, well, if they're innocent people, the FBI will entrap them and frame them for a crime and then lock them in prison for the rest of their lives and it'll be all our fault. They never considered that for a minute. They just wanted to make sure everything's okay. If you see something, say something and all these kinds of things, do the right thing. When in fact, they're the worst criminals, the people at Circuit City who violated the privacy of their customer and then turned the most violent force on the planet against them.
Yeah, it was pretty awful. And then, there were actually a lot of stories about the Circuit City guy afterwards, kind of like lauding his heroism and so forth. And I mean, look, if someone...
Well, people might remember, too, like, that's probably the most memorable part about this case, other than the so-called, you know, pizza part. It was going to be an attack on soldiers from a pizza man or whatever, was that, you know, this hero at Circuit City, you know, found the evidence and it didn't get by him. Like you're saying, yeah, he was lauded and his behavior was lauded. And that the tape showed terrorist training was absolutely taken for granted. If people remember it at all, they remember, oh, yeah, the terrorist training tape. But like you're saying, no, it's just some guys camping in the woods and behaving as men behave, shooting rifles at targets and such.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the most odious things was at trial, there was, like, a pretty long video, like an hour-long video they made to share with everybody. And they were doing these other things, like skiing, like goofing off and in the Poconos, but at trial, the prosecution only showed a little clip of them at the gun range to give the impression that this actually was like a training video, like an Al-Qaeda video, where they just had recorded their like tactics with the guns. So yeah, it was just awful, awful. And that guy, he turned in, he was just doing what people, you know, see something, say something, he was going along with what society was sort of instructing him. But, I mean, the FBI, after realizing that there wasn't actually a plot or anything, the fact that they kept, pouring all this money and time into still manufacturing one is just unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, you know, they got to pretend that there's a terrorist threat or else they might have to get real jobs, and so they don't want to do that.
Right.
Apparently. All right, so now... The guy that you say who originally went to his friend the cop and said and to the FBI and said, help, one of your informants is trying to entrap me, so to speak, that he eventually, I think as you put it in here, inexplicably turned around and gave a map to a guy, one of the informants who had he already pegged that guy as an informant, or this is the other informant that he gave the map to. But he already could have or should have known that they were going to use it for ill. Is that right or not?
Yeah, that was the whole, in my interpretation of the events, the informant, like from reading the transcripts again and again, the informant was coming to him all the time and badgering him for this map. Like, yeah. give me the map.
All right, hold it right there. I'm sorry, we're at the break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Murtaza Hussein from The Intercept. Firstlook.org/The Intercept. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Murtaza Hussein from The Intercept, Christie's Conspiracy, Terror Plot of the Fort Dix Five. Obvious bogus entrapment job from the very beginning. It's kind of amazing to me how the FBI doesn't mind admitting, yeah, an informant was in on it the whole time. The public was never actually in danger. Yeah, in other words, you framed some guy. And we're not impressed, but they just happily admit that every single time. And so, you know, it's not too hard. But here, these guys have done a real, deep dive here, Murtaza and his co-author on what really happened here. And I'm sorry, we got interrupted by the break because I asked you a question right before the break because I wasn't looking at the clock. And it was, the passing of the map. The guy who felt like someone was trying to pressure him into doing something wrong and was so worried about it that he even went to the FBI over it, eventually gave in to the rat and gave him a map. And then, is that the basis of this guy's entire conviction then? Or did I'm sorry. The important question is, what did he know about what that map might be used for at the time? That kind of thing. Cause even if he's entrapped, still, you don't give a map to a guy who says he's going to use it to kill people, probably, right?
I think that what happened was, like, from the transcript, he was being badgered about it all the time. He's like, even when he's giving the map, like, I don't think you should do anything with this. And then, but I think what really got him in trouble is that the FBI, this is in between the 3 weeks from when he told a police officer, when the FBI actually showed up, that's when the map, he gave him the map. And the FBI officer, when he came, he asked him, he told him about the map. He said, so did you give him the map? And then he got scared and he said, well, no. So I guess he kind of bumbled himself into the plot, but it was a very haphazard way. So he was the guy where you could say, well, maybe the informant in this really messed up way succeeded in entrapping him. But he also did try to recruit him. What was different about the Duker brothers is that they never...
Well, wait, on this guy, though, did this guy do anything other than hand over the map, or that's it? And then, I mean, and lie to the FBI about it?
No, that was it.
That was it. Okay, and then, I'm sorry, about the brothers.
And the brothers, they never even knew about the map. They never knew about the plot. No one ever raised it with them over hundreds of hours of surveillance. The other co-defendant, the one who was really in on it, who was really going along with the informant, Muhammad Shure, he wrote a letter to the judge saying that, you know, I made these false statements about the brothers. They didn't actually know anything. The informant himself, who we tracked down and talked to in the piece, he also told us that the brothers never said anything to him about any plot and they didn't know about it. So, like, it's pretty resounding that these guys had nothing to do with anything, and yet they're sitting in ADX Supermax, a few of them, in solitary confinement, 23 hours a day, serving life sentences.
And so... Okay, so one entrapped guy, one guy who was under the influence of an informant, had bragged to that informant that, oh yeah, the brothers, I got them all lined up, they're cool, but that's all they ever had was that hearsay and no actual evidence that the brothers even knew about it. And then I think as you say in here, make sure I'm right about that, but also you have them quoted from, I guess, the surveillance in jail or something where... The brothers are saying to the other guy, you told them what about us? And it rings very believable.
Yeah, exactly. And the guy, when they're yelling at him, he pretended to like be asleep because he's kind of embarrassed that he'd like done all this. So, yeah, that's basically the gist of what they had was this statement of Muhammad Shnur, which he later recanted. And then basically they're like, conspiracy law is such a, you know, a dangerous sort of law because all they have to do is prove state of mind with these guys at the time to try to prove that there's no evidence let's just try to prove their state of mind. So they went through their Google history or their YouTube clips and tried to say that, hey, by the way, these guys actually are terrorists, blah, blah, but they had not any evidence. And anything they could produce was, like, you know, countervailed by a million other things.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just, like, an unbelievably shocking prosecution.
And I guess they must have made a big deal about the guns to the jury, right? They're like, oh, no, a foreigner with a gun. But they just basically they got him on a gun control possession charge for having a gun without first having their whatever level of green card or citizenship status. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So another part of conspiracy law is you have to prove that someone took one overt act towards the conspiracy. So they said that buying the guns from the informant was that overt act. But, you know, actually in the video, which we have of the, like, the gun deal happening, you can hear them saying, oh, this is great. Now we don't have to wait in line at the Poconos next time we go. Because whenever they go to the Poconos, they have to wait in the line for people to rent guns. So the whole time they thought that they were doing this. And actually the informant, he tried to tell, like, when he offered them some guns, he said his friend at a gun store was selling at a cheap price. He offered them RPGs and, like, heavy machine guns and the type of things you'd use if you wanted to carry out a terrorist attack. And the guy got very alarmed. He's like, I don't want any of this. Like, he's like, is everything okay? Like, I'm okay with the other normal stuff. So, like, well, what's up with this? If there's something going on, please tell me. And he said, no, nothing's going on. It's fine. So he actually declined the offer of these really hardcore weapons because he thought he was using them to go to the Poconos.
Yeah. Yeah, no, imagine. It's just like in the mind of every cop in America, apparently, where there's 300 million privately owned firearms. If anybody's holding a gun, they must be trying to kill you with it, so kill them. You just, you know, project whatever fear you want onto somebody holding a gun, even though this is America, the land of the gun, where everybody has a gun, and most people don't mean any harm by it whatsoever. But anyway, it makes for a great scary story for a bunch of terrified jurors, I guess. But now, so this guy, Schnur, he was the idiot dumb enough to get all the way entrapped into this thing. How entrapped did he get? He really was going along with these informants into planning to go to Fort Dix and massacre American soldiers on their base. Is that even true at all?
You know, one thing about Schnur is, like, he's kind of responsible for everyone being in jail. But whenever you talk to the Duca brothers, they refuse, even the family, they won't say anything bad about them because it says, yeah, he did do it, but, like, he was, like, we all knew him. He was like a child. Like, his behavior was so childish. He was always trying to be tough and impress us. We were from Brooklyn, and he was a younger guy, and he thought that he just wanted to be cool in front of us. So this older informant who was almost 40, he starts talking to this guy at 22 and sort of gassing him up and telling him, you know, you should be doing stuff and what's wrong with you, blah, blah. And so he was trying to be tough and going along with him.
Should be doing stuff about what?
Like the wars and, like, getting revenge or, like really, like, the harebrained kind of plots, like, talking about it amongst themselves. And he was, so he did go along with it. He kind of admitted that he went along with the informant. He successfully wasn't trapped by him. But the thing is, like, before the informant came, nothing was even going on, even with him. The one guy who, like, seemed to be, like, receptive to it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just kind of dumb. Like, you know, if you hadn't introduced this grown man into his life and was trying to influence him this way, but even with him, nothing would have happened.
Right.
So, I mean, just even his case, like, we didn't talk about him as much in terms of the problems of the prosecution, but it clearly is. Like the FBI's behavior, even with him, is insane.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, that's an important point. I mean, it's just so outrageous that these three brothers who, for, you know, are the best example where, you know, the feds apparently just completely failed to entrap them into doing anything but buying a gun without a license, which, what the hell is this, Germany or something? North Korea, where you have to have a license to buy a gun? Not to carry one out in public, God forbid, but to own one. Oh, got them on an unlicensed firearm charge, and then try to spin that into terrorism. And then, as you're saying, they're in the Supermax with Ted Kaczynski, with Ramzi Youssef.
Yeah, it's like two of the guys are in the Supermax, and it's like the worst conditions possible. Like,
yeah,
you don't get one 15-minute phone call a month. They're sitting in a box 23 hours a day. Even the 1 hour they get out, it's not like, you know, your recreation hour is basically you get to stand outside in a cage, which is the same size as your cell. So, unbelievable. It's torture.
Yeah. And then, yeah, it's really important, as you point out, about how impressionable the one kid was who then implicated everybody else, because that's something that we see over and over again, too, where the informant just, That's the qualification, right? They don't even find somebody who's really upset about foreign policy necessarily, or really into Salafism or something like that. They just find who's the dumbest kid down at the Islamic bookstore that they can manipulate. And as you say, this guy, all he ever wanted to do was get approval from people who are a little bit older than him. He's a very impressionable young kid, always trying to act tough and whatever. He's the perfect mark for a FBI con artist, basically.
Yeah, exactly. He was a absolute perfect mark, and, you know, it worked. And he went along with it, and not only did he go along with it, he got put on all his friends, too, and he got them all sent to jail for life. So he's doing life, too, and, it's awful.
Yeah, well, and remember, everybody, how much mileage the national security state got out of this one. Oh, my God, a terrorist plot to attack our heroic soldiers at Fort Dix. They were going to use the pizza man's knowledge of the place to kill them all. And boy, did people eat that up, and especially in mainstream media, just repeat that like another 9/11 had been thwarted by our FBI heroes, when, of course, it's never the case. And if it was a real 9/11, they let it happen, right? Like Boston. All right. Hey, thanks so much for your time, Murtaza. Great work here. Murtaza Hussein, everybody.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
God dang. I failed again at getting Mark Perry on the line. Well, I don't know. That's right. I got a ton of news to cover, and maybe I'll get him in a quarter hour, and then we'll... for, you know, keeping a little while longer. Mark Perry. Man, god dang it. I like it better when phone calls result in answers on the other end. People are, hello? Yes, I'm here, I'm ready. That's better. That I would like better. All right. So, I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I was really looking forward to that interview. I even reread that whole article pretty much. All right. I guess I'll move on for a minute, see what happens. U.S. Iranian officials confirm talks to continue past the deadline. Yikes. Then David Sanger and Michael Gordon, the two worst liars about Iran at the New York Times, have this one. Crucial questions remain. And it's sanctions relief, possible military dimensions, and non-nuclear inspections. Still not completely solved, at least according to these bastards. And I just thought it was funny to read in here where he's taken exactly the Netanyahu line that, well, in 15 years, when the deal is, expires... Well, they could make a nuke then. Really? That's hilarious, because I'm pretty sure David Sanger is the exact guy who's been telling us for 15 years that the Iranians have a, quote, illicit nuclear weapons program. Most of the time, he would never explain himself. Well, what are you saying, David Sanger, that their non-proliferation treaty... guaranteed and IAEA safeguarded civilian nuclear program is somehow secretly a weapons program, even though they're not making nuclear weapons at all? or what are you saying, David Sanger, that they have a secret parallel weapons program that nobody knows about, hidden under a boulder that nobody's ever sniffed out before? Is that the theory? You know what? Who knows? Who cares? Either way, how about one and then the other if that one seems less credible at some point, then just switch. It's a lie, man. It doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't have to be real. It's just supposed to make you afraid and pro-government. Oh, government, protect me from the Iranians? Wait a minute. Think about that for a second. Really? The Iranians. That's who you're afraid of. Just because TV and the New York Times said the government said that, well, yeah, we got to do something about them or else the poor Americans. And then that was good enough? I mean, how does... I know America's got a big fake bubble economy, but, you know, so do they, kinda. And their GDP is 3% of ours. America's the world empire. They're barely big enough to push for some independence. You know, like India. They're what Thomas Barnett calls a seam state. You know, like Brazil or Turkey, a moderate power. Anyway. Oh, so afraid. But anyway, so, oh, and by the way, Trita Parsi has a thing where he says, no, they've settled the framework for sanctions relief timing, according to his Iranian sources. They have worked out that one major sticking point still. And, well, Lande has one here in McClatchy. Nuclear talks may hinge on Iran okaying military site inspections. And I think he should be more skeptical about Iran, about Western accusations against Iran. But still, he's Lande, man. He's pretty damn good. And, well, there you go. You know, it doesn't matter if it's all a bunch of forgeries, I guess. Disprove that these forgeries prove that you're making nuclear bombs back then, sometime before. Pretend. I don't know. You could really scotch a deal that way, right? I mean, they could come out in a week or two and say, you know what? They won't admit when they stop beating their wife. And we have Israeli forgeries right here say that they're guilty of the spousal abuse. And so, until, you know, they will explain away these possible military dimensions that we, in fact, won't provide them copies of the actual so-called paperwork. Because that might be too easy to disprove. Just disprove the allegations that we say are in there. Give me a break. Doesn't matter how many times that the officials at the IAEA itself admit that, oh yeah, no, those documents are bogus, probably came from Israel. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, we knew that. That's because we read what Gareth Porter writes. So we've known that for, what year is it? We've known that for 10 years. Okay, good deal. So that was my Iran talk section. I sure hope it works out. And I don't know what's going to happen with America's relationship with Iran or with Saudi or the rest of the Middle East, but I know that it's wrong to keep doing the wrong thing. So what all the consequences will be, I don't know. But America's sanctions war against the people of Iran is absolutely criminal. It's horrifying. So, enough of that. Normalize trade relations. You know, our government accuses them of being authoritarian. Well, what is it but our government acting just like theirs when they engage in all these sanctions and brutality? Bullying. Man, I want to recommend this real quick. I really want to read this book. It's The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. It's not about the Waco massacre. It's about the 51-day war last year in the Gaza Strip. It wasn't really a war. It was a canned hunt of a majority minor population. As he says in here, not only is it a majority minor population, but a huge percentage of that population is under the age of 7. They're just children. And anyway, you know, go read Max Blumenthal, this interview with him. It's at Salon.com, which I know is a ridiculous joke. they used to do some good journalism there, and of course, Greenwald wrote there for a long, long time. Mostly, it's completely stupid. But in this case, they have a really great interview here with Max Blumenthal about the situation in the Gaza Strip. And it's just something else, man. You know, like this part right here, dude. Check it out. You mentioned the demographic angle brings me to Aaron Soffer, whose colleagues nicknamed him the Arab Counter. Who is he? Why is he important? And Blumenthal says, well, he is the chief advisor on demographic engineering, maintaining that at least 70% Jewish supermajority threshold inside so-called Israel proper. And his friends call him Arnon, the Arab Counter. And then, but so here's his quote. When 2.5 million people live in a closed-off Gaza, it's going to be a human catastrophe. The people will be even bigger animals than they are today, with the aid of an insane fundamentalist Islam. Pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. If we want to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill. All day, every day. That is the official chief advisor on demographic engineering in white supremacist Israel. Imagine for one moment if that was Palestinians talking about Jews in Israel. If the situation were reversed for one moment. America nuked the mosque. You know? For Christ's sake. Yeah, man, you gotta read this thing. It's just a small taste. Max Blumenthal, the question is just when. You can find the link in the viewpoint section today at antiwar.com as well. Right back in a sec.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I got Mark Perry. He's the author of Four Stars, The Inside Story of the 40-Year Battle Between the Joint Chiefs of Staff and America's Civilian Leaders. And he's written this hilarious satire for Politico.com. It's called The Pentagon's Fight Over Fighting China. Outrageous piece of fiction that you got here. Mark, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hello, Scott. Hello, Scott. Good to be here, as always.
No, I was laughing all the way through this thing, and I know that you were serious, but it's the subject matter that's just completely ridiculous. I kept thinking of Joseph Heller the whole time I was reading this thing. The fight between the Army on one side, and the Navy and the Air Force on the other. I guess the Marines are stuck with the Navy. They don't get too much play in the piece, but maybe you can elaborate on that. But anyway, they've had a giant fight over the future of war, in which direction, the Pentagon should go here. As you write about, and you start the story after the first Gulf War in 1991. Why is that?
Well, because it was such a success, I think. And you're right, this is, it reads somewhat as a comedy, but it's for people who work in the Pentagon and people in the armed services, this is deadly serious stuff. After the first Gulf War, which was an amazing American victory, military officers began to ask themselves what would have happened if our Air Force and Navy had been challenged, if Saddam Hussein, remember the first Gulf War in 1991, if Saddam Hussein had had an Air Force, if he'd had a Navy, if he'd been able to stop us before we attacked him. What would we have done? What would our success have looked like? And would it have been a victory? And the military at the time was thinking about a future conflict with China. And they began to plan out a conflict in which we did not have control of the seas, we did not have control of the skies, and they came up with a doctrine called air-sea battle and began to promote it very heavily. It called for the development of new weapons to counter those who would deny us access to airspace or to the sea. And beginning then in 1991 until just recently, this was a full-on battle between the Army and the Marine Corps on the one side and the Air Force and the Navy on the other.
Mm-hmm. All right, and now, so this is all framed in the context of China. And you say that sometimes they pretend that it's not, that, well, they're just up against, you know, fictional Bumble Stan or, you know, somebody who might ever try to stop us. But it seems kind of funny, and it goes, I believe, unmentioned in your article here, that all of us know, including everyone who's the subject of this piece, that the Chinese have H-bombs, and not too many of them, but enough to, should be enough to deter the American government from ever, you know, thinking about anything but finding a diplomatic way to get along with them for the rest of the history of mankind, which ought to be a long time rather than a short one, right?
You would think, and you're absolutely right, they have hydrogen weapons, nuclear weapons, and intercontinental ballistic missiles. But the military believes that should there be a confrontation, it would begin conventionally. It'd probably begin at sea or in the air, and that we have to prepare for it. I must say, you know, the military can't seem to make up its mind of whether we should plan for future conflicts or continue our partnership. So we're doing both with China. On the one hand, we're working hard with them to coordinate and to reach understandings on all kinds of fronts. But at the same time, the Pentagon is preparing for a future confrontation with China.
Mm-hmm. And now, and this also seems to be, you talk about Bill Clinton in 1996 during the confrontation when he sent, was it the 7th Fleet to the Taiwan Straits there? That, I mean, obviously this is wrapped up in the pseudo-independence of Taiwan and America's kind of half-pledge to help keep it independent. But it's also in the context of, it doesn't sound like anywhere in the article you're talking about anyone imagining China trying to become a global power and really, you know, create a global navy and try to replace the United States as the global hegemon. We're talking about they're building up the best Coast Guard they can as a defensive, I think you call it, it's a strategy of denial, right? Not of assault, but just trying to make the cost so high for the Americans that they won't want to attack is all.
Well, that's right. In 1996, China conducted a series of naval exercises near Taiwan, which seemed to us to be provocative, seemed to the Clinton administration to be provocative. So we deployed two aircraft carriers to challenge them, and they really couldn't respond. They have one aircraft carrier built since then, but what they've done is they've purchased and developed a barrage of anti-ship missiles, submarines, sea mines, all designed to keep us from gaining access to the waters near Taiwan and to the waters near China. So air-sea battle, this new doctrine adopted by the Navy and the Air Force and now by the entire military, is a response to that. It's a way of attempting to defend our ships and aircraft from the new, highly developed barrage weapons that the Chinese have purchased and invented. And this doctrine is put out there in order to focus the military's attention on these new conflicts that will happen in the waterways and the airways around the world, but especially in regards to China.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the successful defense against a barrage of missiles, ballistic and sea skimming and otherwise? Just more and more F-35s that barely even work anyway?
More and more F-35s, anti-missile missiles, new sensors, intelligence and reconnaissance aircraft, cyber capabilities. I mean, you know, the optimal weapon to use against an anti-access or area denial weapon is to press a button and to shut down the computer network that operates the weapons so that they can't even fire. And it sounds futuristic, but it isn't. It's being developed now. It's at the heart of this new air-sea battle doctrine is the development of cyber weaponry that will make it impossible for any kind of adversary to even launch missiles against any of our ships or aircraft.
Hmm. Well, I mean, that seems worthwhile in and of itself, I guess, if they're actually capable of that. But I guess, you know, it seems like the Americans would be just as much or possibly more vulnerable to those kinds of things since, you know, the Chinese, everything they're doing is new, basically, because they're coming from having such a small military before that America's got a lot more legacy systems there that seem probably a lot easier to hack, right?
Well, that's exactly right. But I say in the article, and I would say to you now, this is what was described to me by one Pentagon official as a self-licking ice cream cone. A self-licking ice cream cone is a phrase used in the Pentagon to describe the development of weapons that cause potential adversaries to develop weapons to counter them, which causes us to develop weapons to counter those,
mm-hmm.
in an escalating ladder of increased expenses, increased budget, increased defense materials that could bankrupt us.
Yeah, increased danger for everybody else, it sounds
like. So you're right. You know, optimally, there's nothing wrong with developing the weapons that we have in order to protect our ships and aircraft. But it would cost us a lot less if we would continue the open partnership with the Chinese and try to reach an accommodation with them rather than climbing an escalating budget ladder that is, at least theoretically, infinite and cost us billions and billions and billions of dollars over the next 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. It doesn't seem like, as far as I know, that there's much of a war among corporate powers over those who like getting along with and trading with China versus those like, you know, who have a very specific vested interest like General Dynamics or Lockheed or Raytheon or the people who are directly, you know, selling technology to the military for use, you know, possible use against them one day. But it seems like all the rest of big business in America, they want to get along with China. They have to.
Yes. And in fact, we just passed through the Congress a trade pact that has enormous potential for increasing trade with China and with Asia in general. And it seems to me, you're absolutely right, this is the solution, that closer economic ties certainly trump any kind of confrontation that we might have, and it seems to me is the solution to heading off confrontations.
All right, now we're a little bit over time into the break, and I don't want to cheat the live audience too much, so hold it right there, Mark, and we'll be right back.
All right, thank you.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Mark Perry, writing this time for Politico Magazine. I don't know who's the editor over there, but they do some good journalism in Politico Magazine. You really ought to check it out. This one is called The Pentagon's Fight Over Fighting China. We haven't even gotten to the Desert Ox, Ray Odierno, and the Army's say and fight in all this yet. We were stuck talking about the narrow interests, not the national interests, but the narrow interests of the military and their contractors as compared to the other 300 million of us. And the sense, of course, that it makes for America to be partners with China in every way that we possibly can, you know, for the common interests of all of humankind and that kind of thing. Navy and Air Force guys, they decide, you talk another turning point was the Afghan war. They're just thrilled. They're amazed with themselves, so proud of themselves, Mark. It sounds like that the Navy was able to coordinate with the Air Force to use their tankers to refuel. Like, this is a miracle. They're, like, patting themselves on the back. Like, this is the greatest thing. It just proves how joint they are and how jointly they can work together and all this. And meanwhile, it sounds like the Army feels like the odd man out. Their infantry hasn't done too well in the last few wars, and nobody really envisions a land war in China, I don't think, except, I don't know, maybe Bill Kristol or something. So the Army's the odd man out, and again, never mind the national interests, they're interested in themselves. And so they've been fighting like hell over this for the last many years, it sounds like, huh?
It makes your head spin, Scott. You're exactly right. The Air Force and the Navy are the ones who shaped this new air-sea battle doctrine, as it's called, and to the Army, that looked like they were getting cut out. And it also looked like, for them, to the Army, it looked like the Air Force and the Navy were engaging in a budget grab. One estimate says that this new doctrine would cost $524 billion over the next 10 years, at the same time that the Army budget is going down. This was a real frightening prospect for the Army. So they moved quickly to try to kill the doctrine, the adoption of these new tactics. They criticized it as provocative to China, which I think it is. They criticized it as a windfall for the Air Force and Navy, and this got to be a real parochial, all-hands-on-deck fight between the services inside the Pentagon over what our tax dollars should buy and when and how much should be bought. And frankly, the Army was outflanked on this one and ended up fighting a rearguard action, which did not succeed, and the result is that air-sea battle doctrine, an Air Force and a Navy doctrine that focuses on ships and aircraft in fighting future wars, is now established as our defense policy, and the Army is going to have to become lighter and more mobile and figure out how to operate in Asia without getting involved in a land war in China. So this was a hell of a fight, and frankly, I don't think it's over yet.
Now, what role did the fight between the advocates of the F-22 and the F-35 have over this? Because it seems like Gates sided against the F-22, and if I remember the speech right, when he was shutting it down, he basically said that, look, we're not going to fight China in an air war, which is what the F-22 is designed to do, but the F-35, maybe it doesn't work, but someday if we use magic somehow and make it work, then it's at least designed, in theory, to drop bombs on the ground. So, in theory, we would be able to use it in our wars, which you might have noticed are against peasants in tiny third world countries that we occupy who can't possibly shoot back at us, not sophisticated first world countries like China who have modern fighter jets for our top gun guys to dogfight with. And so the F-22, it costs too much, but it's obsolete and it's got to go. He sided with the F-35, but then you say in here that, he actually, bought into the whole air sea thing. So is it the Navy and the Air Force don't mind the switch to the F-35 that much, or is that much to do with it?
Well, the saying among defense contractors and weapons developers, when you say that the F-35 doesn't work, is they shrug their shoulders and they say, it works so far, and the parts that don't work, if we throw enough money at it, we'll get it to work. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that the cost becomes enormous with cost overruns all the time. But essentially, they're right. U.S. engineers are phenomenal, the best in the world. Our technical people are the best in the world, and it is true. If you throw enough money at a weapon system, you can get it to work. The question is, can we afford to do that? And we have sequestration now, which means that the defense budget is being slowly but surely pared back. And whether or not you agree with air sea battle, we simply might not be able to afford it. So we're going to have to trim our sails. We're going to have to adopt those weapon systems that we can afford and do the best we can with what we have. But we, the result of Afghanistan and Iraq, outside of Afghanistan and Iraq, which has been tragic and stupid, is the result of Afghanistan and Iraq is that we simply don't have the budgets that that air-sea battle demand that we have in order to do the job that we can. And maybe that's all for the good. Maybe if we pare back our defense budget, we'll also trim our outlook and we'll engage with partnerships that we should be engaging with to begin with.
So, in other words, there's no real contradiction there. Gates was saying, look, I'm all for the air-sea battle doctrine and whatever, but you're not going to use the F-35s. We're the 22s. We're axing the 22s because at least in theory we could use the F-35s in the Middle East too. And so that was, but he wasn't necessarily siding with those who would stay focused on the Middle East rather than East Asia. Is that correct?
I think that Gates came in, took one look at Iraq and Afghanistan, and only took one look, and decided that we had to get out of there and that it was stupid for us to be in there in the first place. And remember, Gates repeated Douglas MacArthur's principle, which was never get involved in a land war in Asia. Now, what's important about the statement is that it doesn't say don't get involved in an air war or a sea war with Asian countries. It says don't get involved in a land war in Asia. And I think that the distinction is something that was important for him. He was willing to build up the Navy and the Air Force, but he was unwilling and remained, to his last day as Secretary of Defense, absolutely unwilling to deploy more troops to Iraq or to Afghanistan, and unwilling to do anything except get us out of there, and I think his instincts on that were absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, all the good journalism says he opposed the war in Libya, but Obama sided with Hillary and did it anyway. And you say in here that when he gave that famous quote that, you know, any president who wants to do this again or anybody advising a president to put a land war, put soldiers on the ground in the Middle East needs to have their head examined, that the Army guys, this is the thing I was thinking of, that reminded me of Catch-22 the most, where the Army guys are so upset over this that they basically go into a panic over this. And then it seems like, you know, like in Nick Turse's journalism, they really decided, well, fine, if we don't have much of a role. Well, you say in here they invented this hybrid doctrine where they're going to be the Marines now. But mostly it seems like they want to pivot to Africa. And there's, you know, 50-something countries they can invade and train up armies to fight each other and take sides in and this kind of thing unending, right?
Well, they have 570,000 troops 3 years ago to pivot with, and now they have 450,000 or 420,000 to pivot with. It's easy for them to talk about how they need to pivot to here or there or somewhere else, but you can't do it without an army. And we're at the lowest levels, deployment levels that we've had now in the last two decades. So, you know, they can talk about pivoting to Africa all they want, but there's not much to pivot with. That's not true for the Air Force and the Navy. We keep the sea lanes open. The U.S., there's just no competition for the U.S. Navy, and there's no competition for the U.S. Air Force. We could defeat the Egyptian Air Force before breakfast, and we could defeat the Chinese Air Force in about 3 days. So this isn't really a controversy, unless you're in the Army and you're looking at troop levels and you're looking at parts of the budget pie. Mm-hmm. That's what they're really worried about, is the cutback to their money that they're getting from the Pentagon for their programs. And to do that, they have to argue that there might be real problems in Africa or there are other problems in Iraq and Afghanistan. But the American people, and certainly this was true for Bob Gates, they just don't buy it.
Yeah. Oh, well, they shouldn't. All right. Well, thanks very much for your time. It's a fascinating portrayal of life inside the officer corps up there in the Pentagon and the incentive structures that they work under and all the rest of it. It's really something to behold. So thanks very much for writing it and coming on the show to talk about it, Mark.
Always my pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Great. Appreciate it. All right. That's Mark Perry. He lives in Arlington and writes for all different places, Foreign Policy, Al Jazeera. Here he is at Politico Magazine, The Pentagon's Fight Over Fighting China. And his book is 4 Stars, The Inside Story of the 40-Year Battle Between the Joint Chiefs of Staff and America's Civilian Leaders. Right back.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. So, man, yeah, you want to talk about life in the empire here. Pentagon seeks $270 billion for nuclear weapons. Deputy Defense Secretary dubs nukes the most important mission of the Pentagon. And, you know, William Arkin, who was on our show last week, he had a great write-up. There are a couple of great write-ups, man. I should have got somebody on the show to talk about this. Maybe I still will. Where these kooks put out this giant study saying, yeah, we need a lot. We need to break out a whole new inventory of usable tactical nuclear weapons. We are sick and tired of not having nuclear wars. It's no fun at all. These no-good, do-nothing nuclear missiles, as Monty Burns calls them. Well, usable or not. Don't you like that? Well, thank God these are 30 megatons, because then hopefully they won't get dropped on anyone. That's how we guarantee, attempt to guarantee a lack of a use of nukes, is we make them thermonukes that could kill 10 million people in one shot. Well, you know, if it was a big enough city, drop a good 20, 30 megaton bomb on Mexico City or New York City. LA's a little more spread out. Hilly. But anyway, So here's how this works. America has no enemies in the whole world. You get that, right? Guess that's why they want the Islamic State. They gotta have something to point to. Ragtag bands and militias. Well, that calls for infantry solutions, and they don't want that, and those things don't work anyway as solutions. So, anyway, it's just the same old economics and politics, just like always. $270 billion plan to upgrade the nukes. We're friends with China, friends with Russia, friends with India and Pakistan and Israel. The UK and France are our NATO allies. Who'd I leave out? That's the nuclear powers right there. Okay, we're not friends with Russia, but yeah, we are. The American people are. We have nothing to fight with the Russians about. The fact that the American Empire is trying to expand the NATO military alliance into former Soviet territory, is succeeding in doing so. That's a problem between the evil warlords who would get us all killed, but that's, you know, it's not like they're the USSR anymore. And then, yeah, the Chinese, hey, that's a billion human beings. How could they possibly be the enemies of us? A billion of them. Whoever are their leading politicians. And what are their leading politicians doing that threatens the United States? They're attempting to build up the ability to resist American domination over their country. That's it. And only, as he says, in reaction to American policy. The self-licking ice cream cone. Everything we do ratchets them up. It becomes the excuse for the further ratcheting effect on our side. And on it goes. And the whole thing's crazy. The whole thing is completely ridiculous. And you don't need some commie one-world government to have an era of no war. You just need the first and foremost for the American Empire to knock it off. I don't know whether the Islamic State will burn itself out or not, but it sure might. And even if not, it's still completely landlocked and ridiculous and will be an extremely weak power. And so, anyway, there are no enemies for the American people other than, you know, the bands of pirates that the American government has created. And then, you know, furthered their goals. First nurtured them, then fought against them, but accidentally benefited them. And then fought directly for them some more, and now fighting against them in a way that helps them some more, too. Also, those are the American people's only enemies. You know, America's friends in the al-Nusra front. But anyway, so what do we need nukes for? Well, just to transfer $270 billion from hardworking American people to the people who deserve it the least, those who manufacture H-bombs and hold stock in the companies that manufacture H-bombs. Hey, think about that, man. You know, you got people, maybe including like you or me, where all the taxes we pay our entire lives, oh man, and in the sales and property taxes, even if you're a renter, you're paying property tax in the price of your rent, believe it. The sales taxes, the property taxes, the income taxes, all the fines and fees and all that, and all that amounts to a rounding error when it, you know, for scrap metal in America's hydrogen bomb construction program. Because, you know, the guys at Honeywell would rather get welfare than work for a living. That's why. They'll spend the tiniest fraction, the smallest fraction imaginable of $270 billion. Like maybe $270,000. Maybe $2,700,000. If they're having a real tough year, is what it would cost them to lobby Congress to give them $270 billion for hydrogen bombs. Ain't you never seen the Terminator, man? God dang, H-bombs. Communism doesn't exist anywhere in the world except North Korea and Cuba right now. And yet our government insists, and you know what? They could negotiate with the rest of the world to reduce nuclear weapons levels to almost nothing or nothing in a year, if that was the consensus, if that was what the American empire wanted to do. We will stop holding extinction to the head of all of mankind if you guys will join us in ceasing to do so. Okay, good. Thank you. Now, there's American leadership in the world, I think, that maybe you'd like to see. But anyway, democracy is stupid. If you really thought that that meant that, you know, having the popular sovereignty of the 300 million of us means that the government will pursue policies that are in the interests of the 300 million of us, why, that's just a rhetorical trick, see? They invoke your power, then they steal all your money, and they spend it on hydrogen bombs. Yeah, they're your enemies, not your security force. Get it? Your enemies. Anyway, that's at news.antiwar.com. $270 billion for nukes. And then, I wanted to say, how much time I got? Oh, I got a couple minutes. The Texas gay marriage thing. Now, I am all for freedom of association. And if bigoted right-wing Christians or Muslims or whoever else for that matter don't want to host wedding ceremonies or bake cakes for gay couples getting married, that's fine. But the Texas governor, who just was the attorney general, is saying that the private religious beliefs of government officials, as in justices of the peace in Texas, override the law of the land, and that they don't have to preside over wedding ceremonies if they don't want to. They have only one other choice, which is to quit. That's it. And I can't believe we're having this conversation. Are you kidding me? They're not human beings. They're government employees. They are agents of the state. They don't have rights. They have powers and authorities delegated to them under the law. Their feelings can burn in hell. If they don't like it, they can quit. Oh, boo-hoo, I don't want to preside over, you know, gay guys getting married. Hey, gay girls, that's all right. Oh, boo-hoo, I don't want to do that. Well, then quit your job and go get a real job instead of being a justice of a peace, of the peace then. Go sack groceries. I'll see you down at the local HEB. How in the world do they think that they could do that? As though government employees on the job are humans rather than agents of law under the law. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to perpetuate any mythology about actual popular sovereignty, checks and balances, separations of powers, a rule of law. There's no such thing as any of that. We just live on a giant farm that grows people to pay for new hydrogen bomb construction.